Kakori, on the shores of the Firth of Forth, was neither a capital nor a center of power in the classical sense. Even so, in 18th century Scotland, one could feel something there that today we would call an economic pulse, ships coming and going, merchants discussing prices, artisans measuring their work in hours rather than abstractions, and neighbors who understood, through daily experience, that prosperity is fragile and depends on human networks. In this landscape of sea and docks, in a town more practical than solemn, Adam Smith was born in 1723. He did so, however, not with a promise of an exceptional destiny, but with an absence. His father had already died. History often begins accounts of illustrious figures with a grand announcement or an early sign of genius. In the case of Adam Smith, the starting point is more intimate and, for that reason, more believable. He was born in Kirkcaldy, in the county of Fife, and was baptized on June 5, 1723. His initial world was dominated by a strong and constant maternal figure, Margaret Douglas, and by the shadow of a father he would never know. That father, also named Adam Smith, had worked as a customs official tied to the excise administration. He died before his son's birth, leaving the family in a situation that combined grief, uncertainty, and, at the same time, a practical need to reorganize life without the presence of the male provider that the society of the time took for granted. To understand what a boy without a father meant in 18th century Scotland, it is useful to set aside current romantic interpretations for a moment. Today, paternal absence can be explained in many ways and does not necessarily imply social decline. Back then, however, the death of a father could alter the trajectory of an entire family. The domestic economy, reputation, community support, and the possibility of formal education depended to a large extent on family stability and social capital. Therefore, the fact that Margaret Douglas raised her son as a widow was not a minor biographical detail. It was the framework that shaped Adam Smith's temperament and his way of observing the world. Kirkcaldy, despite not being a metropolis, had something other towns did not. It was an active port, with commercial links connecting it to the rest of Scotland and to broader routes. Life in a port teaches an early lesson that rarely appears in political speeches but carries weight in real life. Prices change, ships do not always arrive, intermediaries matter, and trust is worth money. Moreover, the port moved not only goods. It moved stories, rumors, news of wars, taxes, treaties, harvests in other regions, and merchant bankruptcies. In this way, even a child who did not yet understand the formal mechanisms of commerce could absorb a fundamental intuition: society is a web of exchanges and dependencies. In the Scotland of that time, the political background also made itself felt. After the Union of 1707, Scotland and England shared a parliament in London, which generated tensions and debates over sovereignty, economic benefits, and loss of autonomy. Under the reigns of George I and George II, the stability of the new order was not unquestionable. The memory of previous conflicts and the possibility of new Jacobite rebellions were part of the atmosphere, even if in Kirkcaldy they were experienced more as troubling rumors than as battles at one's doorstep. In a widowed family, moreover, any political change affecting trade or taxes could be felt with particular intensity. What was discussed in London as imperial policy translated, in a home, into security or distress. Margaret Douglas's household was not a bubble isolated from that world. A widow, even with certain connections, had to be careful with money management, decisions about her son's education, and the preservation of a respectable status.